It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we get the latest in national politics, from Puerto Rican debt to the 2016 presidential race with Harry Enten. First, today, a group of Democrats filed a federal lawsuit against state election officials over redistricting by Republican lawmakers in 2011. The redrawn state legislative assembly map solidified GOP support in certain areas, helped give the party a firm grip on state government. This new lawsuit follows separate litigation that led a three-judge panel to redraw two assembly districts and reprimand Republican lawmakers for drawing their new maps in secret. The panel determined that two districts on Milwaukee's south side violated voting rights of Latinos there, but it left all other districts intact. The new lawsuit alleges the districts are so partisan that they are unconstitutional. Former State Senator Dale Schultz is with us now to talk about why he supports this lawsuit. He's a former Republican state senator from Richland Center. Senator Schultz, welcome to Central Time.
Well, I'm glad to be here today.
So as we mentioned, not the first time this district map has been challenged in court. What makes this new lawsuit different?
Well, first of all, I need to explain a couple things. I am a Republican, and I want Republicans to win. But I think it's very important that we all understand that democracy requires more than just a partisan victory. It requires access for every citizen, and it requires truly competitive elections. I believe elections should be won on ideas, and when elections aren't competitive, when they aren't based on ideas, we tend to see corruption, we see hubris. And that's my interest in this lawsuit. Senator Cullen and I are not plaintiffs, but we are supporting the lawsuit through Wisconsin's Fair Elections Project, because we know what every other citizen that we come in contact with around the state of Wisconsin knows, and that is there's something horribly amiss in our politics, that our elected representatives are choosing their voters rather than the voters choosing them, and they seem to be arrogant and out of touch with what the public wants. And I think you can directly trace what I've just said to the low approval ratings in Washington, D.C., and in Madison, Wisconsin, for the politicians who inhabit the environs of those two capitals.
Now, this is the way things have worked in Wisconsin. Both parties in different states have taken advantage of these kind of redistricting laws. Why does this rise to the level of being something that needs to be challenged in court, something that's maybe even unconstitutional?
Well, let me reiterate something you just said here, and that is we're talking about a problem that is out there in both political parties. In Wisconsin, we just happen to have Republicans in control. In Illinois, it's the other way around. In Rhode Island, it's the other way around. But the results are the same. What happens is the will of the electorate is ignored. And I think when we have that, people tend to get frustrated and angry, and there has to be a way of getting around legislators who hold all the levers of power, and that way is the third branch of government, the judicial branch. And what this lawsuit seeks to do is to, for the first time, provide a test for something that judges in the past have said they have an interest in. And I have to quickly explain something.
Sure.
Or three quick court cases. In 86, at Davis versus Brandenmeier, the court recognized that gerrymandering can be unconstitutional if it's severe enough. That's number one. Number two, in 2004, in a case called Veith versus Jubilier, five justices confirmed that gerrymandering is justiciable. That is, that the courts are competent to handle gerrymander claims. However, the justices could not agree on a test for gerrymandering and, in fact, rejected several proposed approaches. In the third case, in 2006, called Lulac versus Perry, five justices, an outright majority, said they were interested in basing a test on a concept known as partisan symmetry. Partisan symmetry is the idea that a district should a district plan, that is, should treat major parties symmetrically in terms of the conversion of their votes into seats. Neither party should be able to translate its popular support into legislative power more efficiently than its rival. Second of all, you have to understand what is the efficiency gap. And that is the measure all the what is called packing and cracking in a district plan. Cracking and packing are the two techniques used by legislators and they're at the heart of every gerrymander. What it means is that cracking is where parties, supporters are among multiple districts, are apportioned to multiple districts so as to dilute their power. And packing means stuffing party supporters into a few districts where they make up overwhelming majorities. Then all the votes cast by those voters, about 50%, are wasted. The efficiency gap is simply a measure of the difference between parties' respective wasted votes in an election divided by the total number of votes cast. I know that's a lot. We have a short period of time, but what I'm trying to indicate is there's a mathematical, simple procedure that can be used to determine what is unconstitutional gerrymandering, and that's what we're asking the courts to decide, is to use this efficiency gap as a measure. It's something that the courts have experience with. They used it when we first made the switch to one man, one vote, and the first apportionment between rural and urban areas. It's been used, I believe, when we're talking about a racial gerrymandering.
Talking to former State Senator Dale Schultz, he's a Republican. He's supporting a lawsuit announced today over redistricting here in Wisconsin, the redistricting specifically that happened in 2011, saying it gives a partisan advantage to one party, should be changed. Now, Senator Schultz, if you're successful, if the courts, at whatever level it goes to, agree that this is a valid test and that this plan, this 2011 redistricting, doesn't pass that test, what redress are you looking for? What would change if this is successful?
What the plaintiffs are looking for is for the current map to be thrown out, for the legislature to redraw the maps in a fair way. And, of course, if they wouldn't do that, then they'd be asking the courts to do that. Where there's an intersection here is Senator Cullen, I have been going around the state promoting the whole idea of switching Wisconsin to a redistricting plan like Iowa's, where it's given to a nonpartisan commission, and then the legislators vote on the plan, and they have the options to amend plans. It's one way of approaching this. There are other states that have other ideas, but the whole point of what this lawsuit's trying to accomplish, what Tim Cullen and I have been trying to accomplish, is to put the people back in charge, where they're actually picking their representatives rather than having their representatives pick their constituents. And I think if we do that, we will see less hubris, less extremism between the two political parties, and a willingness by both political parties to sit down and actually solve the problems facing this country and the state. I know I've talked fast, but there's a lot to cover here, and this is something people should pay attention to. And if they want to be involved in the Fair Elections Project, they can register on an online petition at fairelectionsprojects.org. On Twitter and Facebook, they can search for Wisconsin Fair Elections and register their support. In the meantime, Senator Cullen and I will continue to be giving speeches around the state support this lawsuit and promote the whole petition project. And finally, I'd like to say, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, there may be an effort in this state, but we're looking forward to efforts in other states where the Democrats are in charge to do the exact same thing so that we can breathe some life back into this democracy that I think most of us would say is essential to our way of life.
Senator Schultz, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on for this period of time, and we look forward to working with all your listeners who have an interest in this issue.
That was Dale Schultz, former Republican state senator from Richland Center, with us to talk about the lawsuit he supported. It's filed today against state election officials over redistricting maps drawn by Republicans in 2011. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, when it comes to police-involved shootings in the United States, it can be hard to get reliable statistics. We talked to a journalist involved in an effort to pin down those numbers. First, we head to Washington for a weekly look at the latest in national politics. The pool of candidates in the 2016 presidential race keeps on growing. Former Virginia Senator Jim Webb, Virginia Governor Jim Gilmore have joined or are about to join the race, and Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker will announce his candidacy on Monday. While Republicans prepare to duke it out among the likely 17 hopefuls, the race between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders is heating up in Iowa and New Hampshire. Here with us now is Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week at this time for a look at the country's national politics. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, Harry, it seems like every time we talk, there's a new Republican, maybe two, vying for the 2016 nomination. 14 announced now, I think. Walker on Monday, John Kasich, Ohio governor, expected on the 21st. Jim Gilmore said he's going to announce later this summer. Have we seen anything like this in recent memory?
No, we haven't. We have never seen anything like this going back to the time of the early 70s when nominees have been selected by primaries and caucuses. I think the highest numbers were really in the mid-teens back in the 70s when this process first got underway on the Democratic side, and now we're racing past those numbers. Look, we could hit 20. Who knows who could say that they're going to jump in? I mean, Jim Gilmore is jumping in. Jim Gilmore was the last elected to office in 1997. That opens up a whole slew of people who could jump in. Maybe Rudy Giuliani. No, he's probably not going to jump in, but it's just the idea of people jumping out of the woodwork and they're declaring. It's incredible.
Now, are any of these really, do you think, not that serious about running for president, just getting their name out there? How many are real? How many are just sort of vanity campaigns, do you think, at this point?
I think that a lot of them are vanity campaigns. I mean, Jim Gilmore has no shot at the nomination, if we're being perfectly honest with ourselves. Someone like Donald Trump, obviously, is just interested in getting his name out there. But obviously Scott Walker is a serious candidate. He'll be declaring John Kasich as a serious candidate. So there are serious candidates among them. And if you just look at, you know, the number of recent office holders who are declaring that they're running, that's also at a high for the modern era since primaries and caucuses decide the process. So it's both serious and non-serious candidates. But we'll see going forward. Maybe there's another non-serious candidate we can all laugh at in a few weeks.
Now, Harry, you guys at 538.com, you love your math. I did a little bit, 100% divided by 17 candidates. If you divide up the voters evenly, that's about 5.8%. So to stand out, you just need to get ahead with 7 or 8% of the voters, and you're suddenly potentially a front runner. So as this pool gets bigger, does it shake things up and make a chance that an unexpected candidate could emerge?
Sure. I mean, what will happen is, obviously, we have a process where we start with Iowa, and then we go to New Hampshire. And obviously, Governor Scott Walker needs to do well in Iowa. And in order to win in Iowa, he only may need 20% of the vote, which is easy for him to get. But also keep in mind, that could also, the fact that you have such a low percentage you would need to win, could open the door to someone who otherwise might not be able to. For instance, Rand Paul, whose father got about 21% of the vote in the last Iowa caucus, and that wasn't good enough to win. This year, 21% could be good enough to win. And that would be very damaging to a serious candidate like Walker, who needs to win in Iowa in order to move forward. So it's going to be very interesting to see going forward whether or not one of these candidates who otherwise might not be able to do well can cobble together just a little bit of a base and be able to advance, and maybe more than just advancing, knock somebody else out who might otherwise have won the Iowa caucus.
Let's stay with Governor Walker, planning to announce Monday early evening. Then he's kicking off a tour of early primary states, including, I think, a few days in Iowa. This might be his big media moment, a chance to get some momentum. What does he need to do in this announcement and this whirlwind tour?
Well, I think what he just needs to do is generate press. Remember, Walker sort of jumped onto the national scene in terms of doing well in these national polls and the Iowa polls when he had a very good speech back in January at, you know, one of these many conferences, and it helped jump him and helped raise his name recognition, and more than that, put him in a favorable view in a lot of Republicans' eyes. So he just needs to be able to maintain a media momentum going forward to be able to jump back and forth, you know, jump back into this sort of lead in the national polls. Remember, polls right now don't really matter in terms of predictability, but what they can do is they can help you raise money, and obviously Walker needs to raise a lot of money to be able to compete with Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, both of whom have been raising a lot of money. And also at the same time, you obviously want to maintain yourself at the front of the polls in order to make these debates, which are very important for keeping name recognition up, because the debates this year, who's getting invited and who's not, is totally dependent on the polling averages. So Walker right now would make the debates, but obviously he wants to be able to maintain sort of that status at the top of the polls, because the last thing any candidate wants to do at this point is not be invited to one of these debates.
Speaking of Marco Rubio, Governor Walker's been talking up a Walker-Rubio ticket with Marco Rubio as his running mate. Rubio has responded he'd be okay with that idea, but put him in alphabetical order. Rubio, Walker. What do you make of that mini flap at this point?
You know, it's just one of those things where I think both recognize that they both have a very good chance of winning the nomination. They're just having a playful banter back and forth. You know, oh, you step aside, and don't worry, I'll make you my VP. You know, they're both going after sort of this conservative vote, while Jeb Bush is going for more of a moderate vote. They're both two newer guys, younger guys, versus Bush is sort of this old guard. So they're going to have this playful banter back and forth, and it'll be fun. But at the end of the day, look, they both want the nomination. That's what they're all about, and both have a very good shot of getting it.
Flipping to the Democrat side, as we talk to Harry Enten from 538.com, our weekly review of national politics. On the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, some polls showing Bernie Sanders a contender in Iowa and New Hampshire. Does he have a shot at winning those? What would it mean if he did win one or both of those?
Sure. I mean, he has a shot at winning one of those two. Keep in mind, there hasn't been a single poll taken that has him within 5 points in either state. Not a single one. And I think only one poll that had him within 20 in the state of Iowa. So, you know, we're all having fun here, you know, thinking the media, oh, we need a Democratic race to get all excited at. And, you know, Bernie Sanders is this fun, lovable guy. He might get a Ben and Jerry's flavor named after him, being from Vermont. He's this old guy. He's a lovable grandfather. He is not going to win the nomination. If he wins the nomination, then every single thing we know about how these nomination processes are decided, it will just be false. But he could win in one of these early states, because his base of voters are these white liberal voters. And if you look at Iowa and you look at New Hampshire, I don't see very many black voters or Latino voters in either of those states. They're almost all white, and many of them are very, very liberal. So he could win there. And if he does win there, you know, get the Clinton camp a little worried. It might get the media very excited. But then as this campaign moves into states like Florida and states with big urban centers, which have large minority populations and big media markets, Clinton's advantage with non-white voters and her money advantage will simply spend Sanders into the ground, and he'll be done, and he'll be the flavor of the month. But keep in mind, at this point, there hasn't been a single poll with Sanders really all that close to Clinton in either of those two states.
I mentioned Jim Webb of Virginia getting into the race. You wrote a piece on him as a reflection of the changing nature of the Democratic Party and why that leaves him probably out in the cold.
Yeah, so basically, you know, Jim Webb is a moderate Democrat from the state of Virginia who used to be a member of the Reagan administration. And if you remember back in the day, 30, 40 years ago, there were a lot of white, southern, moderate Democrats. But if you go over time and you come close to the modern day, what you see is, as a percentage of the base, white, moderate/conservative Democrats now only make up about 25% of the Democratic Party, versus 40 years ago, it was closer to 50%. So that leaves Webb in a very bad position, because if he's only able to compete among those voters, and keep in mind, it's not like he's going to win all of those, it's just not there in the cards for him. He'll make a nice show. He's going to sell a few books, as many of these candidates who are running but really don't have a chance are out there to do. But look, he's going to win a few southern votes. That's pretty much going to be it. And he'll be an interesting personality on the campaign trail, and sort of be of a bygone era where moderate and conservative Democrats were a much larger portion of the base.
Stepping away from the presidential race for a moment, debt crises around the world, big news. Greece, big news. Here in the United States, Puerto Rico right now facing its own debt crisis, the American territory. The U.S. doesn't allow its territories to file for bankruptcy, only states or cities. So Congress having to decide maybe to do something here. What position does that put them in?
Well, you know, Congress just doesn't want to do any more of these bailouts. You remember, you know, the bailouts of the, you know, of all the companies 5-6 years ago, and that made Congress look very, very bad. So they, you know, are going to be very careful. They won't want to be seen as giving bailouts to territories that really shouldn't have been in the position that they are in. But, you know, you said that there wasn't a political presidential angle. I would argue that, in fact, there is one here, because Florida is a state with a lot of Puerto Rican voters, and you see Jeb Bush, You're going to see these Democratic candidates who want to compete in Florida, and Puerto Rico has a growing, Puerto Ricans are making up a growing percentage of the electorate in Florida. So it'll be very interesting to see if you see a sort of split between the presidential candidates who are running, who want to appeal to that base, and members of Congress, who most of whom don't have a lot of Puerto Ricans in their district, saying, you know what, I don't want any part of these bailouts. So it's going to be very interesting going forward. My guess is they'll probably bail them out because there's really no other choice for them to do. But it's going to be very interesting to see how many votes they're able to get for that.
Another issue with presidential candidate implications, Iran negotiations, deadlines keep getting bumped back. Many in Congress, particularly Republicans, want to leave, might want to block whatever comes out of this. Could they? Are they likely to be able to stop it if they don't like it?
It seems unlikely that they would be able to, because remember, what they need here is it's not so much of okaying the deal. It's more of saying, no, I don't want the deal. So they need the majority of the votes, and more than that, a filibuster-proof majority to be able to say, no, we don't want that deal, versus if they, instead of getting 67 votes or 60-plus votes to be able to say, I want that deal, they need 60-plus votes to say, I don't want that deal. And with a lot of Democrats who are going to stay by President Obama's side, it seems very, very unlikely that they'll be able to block any package. But at this point, who knows if there's going to be a package that they're going to be able to block, because the deadline's getting pushed back, 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 and back. By the time any deal is passed, I might be dead. So, you know, at this point, it just doesn't seem like there's much of a deal that's on the horizon. And Dick Durbin from the state of Illinois, senator, says it's 50-50 chance at this point.
All right, so, Harry, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us. Hope you're still alive by next week for our next conversation.
Well, I hope so, too. I hope to do it again.
That's Harry Enten with 538, joins us each week at this time with the latest in national politics. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. Police shootings and the death of others in police custody have been in the news a lot in the past few years. Some, like Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, almost a year ago, and Tony Robinson in Madison earlier this year, sparked protests and widespread media attention. Others have gone unnoticed and uncounted, and reliable numbers have been almost non-existent. Our next guest is part of an effort to find those numbers. Oliver Lachlan is a senior reporter for Guardian US and a member of the reporting team on The Counted, an interactive investigative project documenting police killings in the United States. Oliver, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So why did The Guardian tackle this project?
Well, I think it really comes down to what you just mentioned in your intro there. There are no official statistics out there that accurately reflect the number of people that are killed by police in the United States each year. So, you know, it was our thought that obviously it's an ambitious project, but we thought that there's enough public merit in trying to do something like this. So that's where the project started, really.
And what have you found? Big picture, what kind of numbers do you see out there?
Well, so the project's only been going since the beginning of 2015. We launched in June, and that's obviously with a backlog of data that we've been looking at for a few months. The total we've got at the moment as of this afternoon, so it's a live database that we update twice, three times, sometimes four times a day. We've got 584 deaths so far this year. Now, that's not just shootings. That's deaths in custody like that in Baltimore with Freddie Gray. That's deaths after people have been tased by police, and that's also deaths that have involved collisions with police vehicles. So it's obviously quite a striking number, especially when you, I suppose, compare it to other countries around the world. So that's what we've got so far. The idea is to keep going for the entire year and see what results we get at the end.
And we'll break down those numbers more in a little bit. But first, talk about how you find this information, given that there's no centralized federal clearinghouse for this information. States, cities all vary in how they handle this. So how are you digging this up?
Well, so there's a variety of methods that we have. A lot of it is to do with local media reporting. So whilst you're right, yeah, there is, you know, the way in which records are kept varies from state to state, jurisdiction to jurisdiction, city to city. Local media do report on these deaths. Often they're not very long reports. They can be, you know, a couple of paragraphs where bare bones of a story, I suppose, is laid out. So we try and keep abreast of all of that. We use public records. We interact with police forces when we hear that something might have happened. And a big part of this is through our audience. So the moment we launched, the idea was that this was going to be partly crowdsourced. So we're very, very open about this. We want people to email us in when they hear something, even if it's just an update in a case that we've already written about. So there are lots and lots of different ways, some of which are, I suppose, what you call traditional journalistic methods, you know, hitting the phones, making public record requests, that sort of stuff, and others are more sort of, you know, 21st century practice, relying on the internet.
And these crowdsourced ones, then you try to confirm before you add them to the count?
Of course. So every single incident that is included in the counted database has been gone over by a reporter here. You know, often that means putting in calls after we've had a tip-off from somebody online. You know, everything that's in there is manually inputted in. So we will write the descriptions, which are often based primarily on the police department's account of what transpired. We try and source photographs, and one of the key things that we're really trying to do is track the status of the investigation that arises into the death. So that means often, you know, going back to a case 3, 4, 5 times, as much as it needs to be until we see it through to completion.
And so what are the parameters of how you decide whether to count someone as killed by police or law enforcement agencies, or a report that doesn't meet the standards of this count?
Well, it's pretty straightforward, really. You know, there's got to be some level of responsibility leveled at a law enforcement agency. Now, there are other crowdsourced accounts out there that are run by people online that tend to count, you know, as well as the stuff that we're counting, will count things like somebody who died while they were, you know, in a car chase with police and had crashed their vehicle. Now, for us, that doesn't necessarily count. What we're counting are basically those categories that I gave you a little bit earlier. So those people that have been shot by the police, people who have died after they've been tased by the police, people who have died in police custody, and that's following an altercation in police custody most usually, and those that have been struck by a vehicle.
Talking to Oliver Lachland, he's with Guardian US, and he's a member of the team on a project called The Counted, trying to put a number on police-involved killings in the United States. Now, there isn't a value judgment here. You share information about each of the cases you count and describe the circumstances. Some might be an active firefight with a suspect or somebody in the process of a murder. These aren't necessarily all unjustifiable police-involved killings.
Of course. I mean, the point of the project really is not to necessarily cast aspersions on each one of the incidents. We make no qualms in saying that, you know, there are lots of people included in that database that to many people, you know, may have been engaging in criminal activity at the time they were killed by police, may have fired on officers themselves. You know, one of the guys that escaped from the prison in New York and was subsequently shot dead by law enforcement in New York State is in that database because, you know, it comes down again to the fact that there is no reliable data out there at the moment. So our premise is basically we count everybody irrespective of whether the incident was justifiable or not, and we're not making judgments on that.
And you try to determine the people who die in these cases, whether they were armed or unarmed, and you have a racial breakdown there, too. What kind of things did you find out?
Well, yeah, so obviously, you know, as well as trying to provide this impartial resource, it obviously comes off the back of an ongoing national discussion, really, about policing practice around the United States, and a lot of that discussion is weighted towards dynamics of race, and that's obviously arising from what happened in Ferguson. It's what's happened recently in Madison, Wisconsin as well, in Baltimore, etc. So, you know, we're collecting about 16 different data points, one of which is ethnicity, and another of which is whether the person who died was armed or unarmed. And, you know, when we collect bits of data like that, it allows us to stratify, it allows us to look at you know, things like whether there's a racial disparity between people who are unarmed and killed. And so what we found is that basically black Americans are twice as likely to be killed unarmed as white Americans. About 30% of deaths have occurred where the person who died was black have been unarmed, whereas about 16% have been unarmed and white.
In reporting related to the Counted project, you looked at standards for the use of lethal force among police agencies. You found that most states, I think all states, didn't meet international standards for use of lethal force by police officers.
So that actually wasn't our analysis. That's an analysis that was done by Amnesty International, and they went back and looked at laws on the books in all 50 states and the District of Columbia, and compared that with guidelines that are set out by the United Nations, and came to that conclusion that in every single state, guidelines that are available to law enforcement officers on the use of lethal force fall below international standards, which basically has at the heart of it the preservation of life and the idea that the use of lethal force should be an absolute last resort.
Now, you were in Madison to cover the Tony Robinson shooting that you mentioned back in March. You've been following that story since yesterday, or earlier this week, was the four-month anniversary. Share your perspective on that shooting and how it fits into this wider project you're doing.
Well, yeah, so the Tony Robinson case is an interesting one. I've been covering it before the county was launched, but Tony's case does sort of seem to fit in with one of the trends that we've identified. Obviously, he was a young man of color. He was biracial, but in our database, we've identified him as black because we believe that's how the police would have defined him at the moment of the incident occurred. Now, he was an unarmed black man, and as we've just discussed, you know, his case falls into this disparity that we've identified of unarmed black people being more likely to be shot. So, I mean, that's one aspect of it. I mean, the other aspect, of course, is that cases like Tony's, which were obviously huge news in Wisconsin, but may not have been, you know, covered throughout the United States as much. You know, keeping databases like this allows us to identify cases that are less prominent and perhaps warrant a bit more interrogation. So I suppose his death sort of fits in along those lines as well.
Now, an interesting aspect of the coverage of the online project you're doing is that you aren't just collecting the numbers. You're sharing the names, a brief summary of the circumstances of the person's death, and then links to more information to reporting by other sources on those shootings. Why was it important to do that?
Well, I think, you know, what happens, and I suppose it's a journalistic tool, really. You know, the idea is that the database is very interactive. You know, we've got readers at the heart of it, and I think we want people to be able to read a bit more about what happens in some of these cases that aren't documented. And, you know, as we touched on before, a lot of the cases are involving people that have been accused of criminality, whatever it is, just before they died. But I think as a sort of resource for readers, the way, you know, if we're able to make it feel more human, allow people to filter the data as much as they can, see photographs of people, hear a little bit about, you know, what happened in the last moments of their lives. We feel like that's a more engaging and interesting experience for a reader who's perhaps trying to, you know, search out some of the stories behind the data just as much as the data itself.
And Oliver, before we let you go, have you gotten response from the people involved in law enforcement from local police departments on up to the Department of Justice on your project?
Well, the project itself was welcomed by a number of members of Barack Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing, which is obviously a commission that he brought into being after what happened in Ferguson. And they were very happy about it. You know, one of the big calls arising from the movement in Ferguson and in other cities where there's been, perceived police impunity is that these records should be kept. So, you know, that's been fantastic for us. And one of the other things that we did was we spoke to relatives of people who had died at the hands of police, including Tony Robinson's mum, who was really happy to see that we were doing something like this. In terms of how it's been received by local law enforcement agencies, I mean, there are 18,000 police departments around the United States, and so it's really very difficult for us to generalize and say how it's been received across the country. I mean, I think a really interesting point to think about, though, is that this is really a kind of a consensus view in Washington. Both the president and the previous Attorney General, Eric Holder, have said that these records should be kept. So from our point of view, you know, we agree with those calls, and we don't necessarily think that what we're doing is particularly controversial or political in itself. We think it's, an important piece of public interest journalism.
Oliver, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
That's Oliver Lachlan. He's a senior reporter for Guardian U.S., a member of the reporting team on The Counted, an interactive investigative project documenting police-related killings in the United States. Coming up, we talk with WPR criminal justice reporter Gilman Halstead about efforts to track gun violence here in Wisconsin. First, a look at the news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Before the news break, we heard about the Guardian newspaper's U.S. Bureau working to count deaths related to police-involved shootings, tasings, deaths in police custody around the United States, trying to put a number on that. Joining us now is Gilman Halstead, WPR's criminal justice reporter. Gil, thanks for stopping by.
Nice to be here.
Well, let's start. I want to get to a project you've been working on here in Wisconsin, but first, related to police-involved deaths, how do we track these? How does the state track these here in Wisconsin?
Well, since the law was passed last year, last April, requiring independent investigations, the majority of those, or I think close to a majority of the ones that we've had since then, have been investigated by the Department of Criminal Investigation and the State Department, because except for Milwaukee and Madison, but even in Madison, the most recent one that we had was the investigation was handled by the state DOJ. You were just talking about that before, Tony Robinson's case. So you can follow those. They're being tracked, and the documents are being maintained on the Department of Justice website. There's been four so far this year that I'm aware of, and they have produced reports on three of them. There's one in Kenosha that I was just looking to see if I could find any information about. I think that was the most recent one that the investigation has not been complete yet. So you can see all of that information. And from my perspective as a journalist, they're doing a pretty good job of releasing a really comprehensive set of information about what happened. The concerns that have been raised and that I think continue to be raised across the country is even when you have these independent investigations, to what extent this sort of police blue wall of silence or wall of loyalty that you know has always been the case for some understandable reasons, you know, whether law enforcement people are really going to be objective and unbiased in all the reporting they're doing, because to get the experience to do the investigation, you pretty much have to have been a police officer, and that raises concerns among the families of the victims and other reform advocates trying to see if they can get it even more unbiased. You know, when we passed the law here, there was an effort to make it to require another level of investigation or of clearance, and that did not make it into the law, to have a non-police people who were totally not involved in the process actually review it and then make a recommendation.
Now, this Guardian project was trying to put a count on, if they can, every police-related death in the U.S. I want to turn now to a project you tackled last year, trying to count the number of gun-related homicides involving a shooting here in Wisconsin. What led you and your colleagues to kick that effort off?
Well, I have to give credit to Chuck Kornbach. I mean, the way he viewed this was a way to inform the debate over gun control and gun rights with some numbers that a lot of them are floating out there all the time from on different sides of this. And we decided to focus on one of those, which were actual gun homicides, what Chuck called the sort of slow-moving mass murder, and to try to track that slow process death by death as it went on. It was difficult for just two reporters to do this and really get a lot of the information about each of those deaths. We had to track the daily reports from other news agencies, local news agencies around the state. But of course, most of them happened in Milwaukee, so we needed to develop a good relationship with the Public Affairs Office of the Milwaukee Police Department and try to get as much information from them as we could. And I think it worked out. We were able to keep track, and now we have something to compare it to as we report maybe on more individual ones as we go on this year. Of course, it's rather depressing that we're already very close to what the total in Milwaukee was last year, and we've still got almost half the year left. I certainly can't say that our reporting had an impact on the people who were doing the shooting.
What was the tally? What was the toll last year?
The toll last year statewide was 114 gun homicides. It was actually a somewhat larger total of around 128, but we focused on ones that were actual quote-unquote homicides. And when we were doing the count, we also included some suicides and, I believe, six what were ruled self-defense murders.
So you removed those from the overall
total? We removed those from the total, but we still counted them overall. And then when our report was 114. And so, so far this year in Milwaukee, I think there have been 77. And last year there were 86. So we're just...
So 86 for the whole year last year.
The whole year
77 so far this year.
Right.
Sad news.
Yes, it is sad news. And there are an increasing number of young people being killed. I think we've already reached the same total as last year for people under 18 have already been shot. There have been five teens or younger shot this year.
So as I understand, you're not doing the same count death by death, but how does that, having that number last year, how does that inform reporting here in the state on these issues this year, do you think?
Well, I think it gives us the opportunity to measure the effectiveness of the of policing and efforts to actually reduce the gun homicides. I mean, we just heard from, we just reported on Chief Flynn being reappointed, even at a time when the gun deaths are rising. And, you know, he now feels, I think partly because of all the reporting that's been going on, a commitment to say, well, I guess we're still not doing everything we need to do. So we're going to try to increase the neighborhood policing and community policing and efforts to get those guns off the street.
All right, Gilman, thanks for coming by and sharing your reporting, as always. That was Gilman Halstead, Wisconsin Public Radio's criminal justice reporter.